We'll now call forward Brother Grant to speak to us on Daniel chapter 2.
Good evening, brothers and sisters and young people. Well, those of you that were here last class will remember that we got partway through chapter 1 and I had to make a decision on what to do tonight, whether to finish chapter 1 or not, and I've decided to just make two brief points about chapter 1 and then move on to chapter 2. We remember that we made the observation that Daniel can be divided into two parts. And the first half of the book, first six chapters, we notice that they are all centred around pretty much life in the palace. And so we titled them Encounters with the Kings. And there's a reason for that. And we observed that there's good reason to believe that Nebuchadnezzar himself and King Darius became believers in the God of Israel. And in fact, we saw how in chapter 4, the confession of Nebuchadnezzar becomes a hinge point in the book, and the section of Daniel that was written in Syriac hinges or pivots around that confession of Nebuchadnezzar. So God was working with the kings for a purpose, and that purpose was to help change the heart and to turn his people that were in Babylon. You see, they went into captivity and they stayed there for two reasons, for two wills, their own will and the will of the king. God was working to change the will of the king, but he was also working to change the will of his people. Let's go to chapter 1, brothers and sisters, just briefly. There's just two points I want to make from chapter 1. And the first is this, the question of why it was that Daniel refused the food of the king. Now, I think there are two reasons. I think one was, let's read. Daniel says, we read in verse 8 rather of chapter 1, but Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor with the king's wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. I believe there's two reasons why that was so. The first has to do with the food itself. I do believe that the food was likely to have either been offered to idols, or it would have been food that would have not been prepared, or food that the Jews weren't meant to eat. If you think about it, Daniel was in the palace and he was setting an example for the rest of the nation. Can you imagine Daniel being in the palace eating swine's flesh and telling the Jews how they needed to separate from the nation around them? He was there as an example, and what Daniel did in the palace would have been proclaimed on the housetops. There's another reason which I think is important so far as the rest of Daniel is concerned, and that is there was an association between the food and religion. Now, the reason why I say that is because that becomes a theme right throughout Scripture. Let's turn to Jeremiah chapter 51 and verse 7. Jeremiah chapter 51 verse 7 we read, Babylon hath been a golden cup in Yahweh's hand that made all the earth drunk. The nations have drunken of her wine, therefore the nations are mad. So to drink Babylon's wine resulted in a madness, a distortion of the thinking. And the same idea is picked up in Revelation chapter 14 verse 8. Let's turn there quickly. Revelation 14 verse 8, and we'll see what sort of distortion of thinking it's talking about. So we're focusing here on the wine that was put before Daniel and the underlying principle behind it, the connotations or the association of that wine with the religion of Babylon. Revelation 14 verse 8. And there followed another angel saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. And while we're there, we have it again in Revelation chapter 17, verse 4. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet colour, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And finally, in Revelation 18, verses 3 and 4, "For all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies." Interesting that that word delicacies is the same word or similar to the kaldi word used in Daniel chapter 1 to describe the king's food. So whatever that association was, we're not told the details of it, but I do believe there was an association between that food and Babylonish religion. So that's the first point I'd like to make. The second point is an unstated fact, and that is that from what we're told, it was only Daniel and his three friends that had a conscience about eating the king's food. And when you think about it, that's quite a remarkable thing. There could be more than one reason why the others partook of the food. It could have been that they were blissfully ignorant. It could have been that they said, "Well, what's the issue? Don't make a big deal about it." Or they could have understood what the issue was and they acquiesced. That means to just give in, basically. And I think, brothers and sisters and young people, when we look at Scripture and we look at the figures that are used to describe the brotherhood, the ecclesia, in the last days prior to the return of Christ, what we've got is a situation where the brotherhood is assimilated with the world. And for any one of those three reasons, that can happen. That people don't see the issue, or they're blissfully ignorant, or they do see the issue and they acquiesce. But Daniel and his three friends saw the issue, and they were prepared to give their lives for that issue. And so I think the lesson of chapter 1 is a very relevant lesson for today, brothers and sisters and young people, that we have to be able to see the issue. And the only way of doing that is to maintain a close relationship with God. As I said, they're the only two points I wanted to make about chapter 1. So let's move on to chapter 2. So the outcome of chapter 1 was that Daniel and his three friends were numbered with the wise men of Babylon. And that brought them into the inner circle of the king's counsellors, a position of great responsibility, but a position of great influence that over the course of the 40-year reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel and his three friends were going to be able to influence the heart of the king. Life seemed pretty good in the palace for a while. It was a far cry from their colleagues, the captives who were by the river of Kibar. Daniel and his three friends were in the palace, enjoying the relative luxury of the things that the king had provided. But life was soon to change quickly. The four were only beginning to adjust to their new position in life when they were hastily apprehended and marshalled by the king's guard. And they were informed that they, together with the other wise men of Babylon, were going to be executed at the king's command. What do we know about Nebuchadnezzar at this point in time? Well, prior to being king, he was a general of the Babylonian army. He didn't value life very much. And we can see in his discussion, his brief discussion with the wise men of Babylon, he gave them a soft option. He said, "Tell me the dream, or I'll cut you in pieces." It was that simple. That's the sort of man that Nebuchadnezzar was. So in the space of a very short period of time, the life of these men changed dramatically. And you know, that's how things are in life sometimes, brothers and sisters and young people. Tomorrow can be a very different day to today. And that's what happened to these four men. And trouble came upon them. But trouble, brothers and sisters, isn't a time to doubt God. Trouble is a time to turn to God, as these men did. When you think about it, their world had just caved in. They were put to the test. And I think the words of Psalm 46 in verses 1 and 2 describe perhaps the feelings of these men at the time. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore will we not fear, though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea. Well, how did Daniel react to this? Verse 14, then Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, which was gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. And he answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree so hasty from the king? Then Arioch made the thing known to Daniel. And we know how the story unfolds, that Daniel asked for time. He asked for a reprieve. And that after that reprieve, he said, I will tell the king the interpretation of the dream. Think about that. Daniel says, give me some time and I'll make the king known the interpretation. He was believing, brothers and sisters and young people, in something that was humanly impossible. The ability to read another man's mind, something that another man had dreamed. And Daniel believed that God could do what he couldn't. And you know, when the Bible talks about us being justified by faith, it's that sort of faith that it's talking about. It's talking about the faith that believes that God can do the impossible. That's the faith, brothers and sisters and young people, that justifies us. You know, the incidents that we read of in Daniel feature in Hebrews chapter 11, where there are three consecutive examples of faith that are taken directly from the lives of Daniel and the three friends. Think about this. Those who through faith stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, and you know the next one, escaped the edge of the sword. So we have to ask ourselves a question then. Are there things in our life which we believe are impossible? And if we do think that they're impossible, then we need to do something about that. We need to have faith, not that God will necessarily do what we ask, but we need to have faith that God can do what we ask. That's the faith that justifies. So we know what unfolded. Verse 19, then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. We have to ask the question, why was it that all of the visions that are given from chapter 7 onwards are given directly to Daniel? But here they're given to the king. Why not just give the vision to Daniel? I mean, after all, he had this night vision and it was revealed to him. Why didn't God just do that in the first place and just cut Nebuchadnezzar out of the picture? Well, as we said, brothers and sisters and young people, God is working with the king. And the fact that there was a man who was able to read his mind, read the dream that he had, was to give Nebuchadnezzar the confidence that if the God of Israel could reveal his thoughts, he could also fulfill the vision. So when were the visions of Daniel given? Daniel 2 is the first of several visions, and it's useful to understand when they were given. If we look at that slide there, we can see it tells us a number of things. First of all, that the first vision in Daniel chapter 2 was given in around, I think it's 604, 605 BC. But notice when the next vision is given. Around 50 years later, the vision of chapter 7 is given. That's the first thing we can observe. That's almost a lifetime. You know, we can read through these visions and think that they happened fairly soon afterwards, but 50 years occurred or took place between those two visions. That's a long period of time. That's the first takeaway. The second thing is, count the number of kings that Daniel served. There's seven kings from three different nations. That tells us something about the character of Daniel, doesn't it? His integrity. And the other thing to observe is this, that this vision in chapter 2 took place in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar. Who knows what the significant event was that happened in Judah the same year? It involved King Jehoiakim. He was presented with a scroll. And what did he do with the scroll? He threw it in the fire. So isn't it significant that in the very same year that over in Judah, the king receives a scroll, the words of God, and he throws it in the fire. Meanwhile, in Babylon, in the same year, God reveals a prophecy to Nebuchadnezzar, which he understood, or which he at least believed. We need to ask ourselves, when we consider the vision that Nebuchadnezzar saw, this great image, and we're not actually told what the image looked like. We're told that it was terrible in form. We need to ask ourselves a fundamental question: what is it depicting in general terms? Well, let's consider firstly what it is not depicting. It's not intended to be a historical representation of nations that impacted the Holy Land. Because if it was, then we're missing something. We're missing these nations that had bearing over the Holy Land during that period when the Jews were in exile. So that's what it's not representing. It's important to understand, of course, what it is representing. The Kingdom of Babylon, and this is important, the Kingdom of Babylon began and will end as a joint military and religious power. The image as a whole is the latter-day manifestation of that kingdom on the verge of destruction by the stone power. And so the various parts of the image then are really depicting the various phases, evolutionary phases, of those military and religious powers. So why do we refer to it as the Kingdom of Babylon rather than just simply the Kingdom of Men? Because, you see, the Kingdom of Babylon had a particular character, and that character permeated the whole of the Kingdom of Men. And the two qualities about that character was that it was in opposition to God and it was assertive. And that applied to both the military and the religious aspect. In chapter 4, we see, you remember, there was a Babylonian stump and it was banded with iron and banded with brass. And what that in simple terms was telling us was that the Babylonish character or empire was going to be preserved. And so that's why we're using this language of the images representing the Kingdom of Babylon. And that's why Brother Thomas says in exposition of Daniel things like, in the vision of the ram and goat, the Babylonian power in its Roman manifestations is represented by the little horn of the goat. And so when we get to the feet of the image, it's interesting to note that the religious power at that time is styled Babylon the Great. So you see, it's the Kingdom of Babylon, really, that is what the image is depicting in its various phases. So apart, of course, from chapter 2, there are other prophecies which are given in Daniel. And let's spend a little bit of time looking at the relationship between those prophecies. So we said that the image as a whole depicts the Kingdom of Babylon in its latter-day manifestation. That's important to understand, in its latter-day manifestation. And the reason for saying that is in chapter 2 and verse 28, where we read, "But there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets, and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Okay, so chapter 7 tells us about the kingdom of Babylon in relation to the saints. So the titles that I've given to these chapters is not so much about the what, but rather the why. And I think you'll see the importance of that in a short while. So the first chapter deals with the kingdom of Babylon in relation to God's saints. And so it's going to deal with the manifestation in particular of the religious power in the West when it's telling us about how that kingdom would affect the saints. In chapter 8, we have the kingdom of Babylon in relation to God's sanctuary and the people. Likewise, in chapter 11, we have the kingdom of Babylon in relation to God's holy land. You'll recall that in chapter 11, we have a king of the north and king of the south with respect to the holy land. And the whole of the chapter is about the oscillating struggle for power over the holy land. And it's probably worth noting, just to reflect back on chapter 8, that the vision itself is styled the evening and the morning vision because it focuses on God's sanctuary for part of it. And finally, in chapter 12, we have the kingdom of Babylon in relation to the righteous, both the mortal and immortal. Now, there's another reason, and perhaps I'll just finish by saying, whoops. The chapter 9 is about the Messiah in relation to the sanctuary, the city, and the people. Now, there's another reason for labelling the chapters in this way, and that is this, that it helps to bring God to the forefront. Because, you see, Daniel isn't simply a history book. For example, when we're talking about the kingdom of men, the military aspect of the kingdom, it affected many parts of the then-known world, but it's only one part of the then-known world that God's interested in telling us about. And it's really telling us about that part because it affects God's people. So yes, whilst it's true to say that some chapters deal with the military aspect of the kingdom of men and other chapters deal with the religious aspect, that's true. But it's only so far as they are in relation to God's people, his sanctuary, his land, or the saints. And so what we find is that God manifests, that Daniel is telling us not only that there's going to be a destruction of the kingdom of men and a replacement with the kingdom of God, he wants to tell us how he's going to do that. And he's going to do it in a particular way. He's going to do it in a way that reveals himself. What do I mean by that? For example, he reveals himself when his vessels are profaned, chapter 1, when his saints are persecuted, chapter 7, when his people are vanquished, chapter 8, and when his land is overrun, chapter 11. In chapter 7, we're told that the faithful who destroy the religious power are described as the saints of the Most Holy. So it's a fitting term to describe a religious power that's going to be overcome. Similarly, in chapter 8, where we have the destruction of a military power, it's not the saints of the Most High that are going to do that work, even though it's referring to the same group of people, it's styled the prince of princes. So you can see that God's interested more in his people, his saints, his land, his sanctuary, than the Gentile nations. So it's not a history book, as we know. It's about the impact of these nations on God's people. And in the process of describing that, God brings out various features of that kingdom. Okay, let's look at the identity of the first or the upper part of the image. You might be thinking, well, what is there to say about this? Everyone knows it. Well, let's think about perhaps not so much the what, but the why. So the identity of these three metals is not hard to ascertain. We know, for example, if we go to Daniel chapter 2 and verse 38, we're told the identity of the gold. Daniel 2, verse 38, and wheresoever, so this is Daniel's interpretation, wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven, hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou, Nebuchadnezzar, art this head of gold. And historically, well, that's fitting because we know that, as we said, the thinking of Babylon is what permeates the entire image. And historically, we know that the Babylonian kingdom was superseded by the Medo-Persian, and the Medo-Persian was superseded by the Grecian. And that's consistent with the biblical record. We know in Daniel chapter 8 and verse 20 and 21, we won't turn to it, but we're told there that the kingdoms that follow the Babylonian kingdom were the kingdom of, were the kings of Media and Persia and the king of Grecia. So let's look briefly at the territories that those three empires occupied, because that's going to be relevant for some of the things that we will talk about later on in our studies. Now, remember we said, before we look at these maps, remember we said that in the latter days, there's going to be a power that will occupy all of the territories, or have control at least, over all of the territories that the previous empires held. So beginning with the Babylonian Empire, it lasted a relatively short period of time, 74 years. And it ended, of course, when Cyrus the great king of Persia conquered Babylon in fulfillment of Isaiah 45. So as you can see, it was confined mainly, we might say, to the Middle East. The Persian Empire, on the other hand, lasted a considerably longer, over 200 years. And that empire ended in 331 BC when Alexander the Great defeated Darius III at Gaugamela. So the extent of the empire increased compared to the previous Babylonian Empire, and as well as that, the duration of the empire increased as well. In the case of the Persian Empire, it extended from Thrace in the west to the Indus River in the east, considerably greater in extent than the Babylonian Empire. The Grecian Empire occupied pretty much the same landmass as what the Persian Empire did, and for roughly about the same period of time, less than 200 years, but still around that same period of time. And the empire ended when the Roman commander Aemilius Paulus defeated Macedonia at the Battle of Pydna in 168 BC. And you can see where Pydna is located over here in Greece. And you might note also on that map that the colours here relate to the four generals that followed Alexander the Great. So we notice then how, as we progress down through the image, that the quality of the metals declines, and yet we find that the extent of the empires, both in duration and in the territory that they covered, got larger. So what then, the question is, what is the meaning of the declining value of the metals? Well, I think it's hinted to us in chapter 2 and verse 39, where Daniel says to Nebuchadnezzar, after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee. In what sense was it inferior? Well, think about it. Nebuchadnezzar was an autocrat. He slew whomsoever he would. The Persian kings were subject to their own law, which they themselves could not change. The Greeks had a democracy. The Romans had a senate. So as we progress down, the nature of the rulership declines. Pretty much you can go to any commentator and they will make the same observations about the first three metals. No one really gets that wrong. But it's the interpretation of the feet and the toes is where there is quite a bit of variance. And so that's where we want to spend most of our time tonight. Let's move on then to think about the identity of the iron in the legs. How can we establish what the iron is? Unlike the gold, silver and brass, the Iron Empire is not named. Why? Well, because it was diverse, as it says. It was diverse in this sense that it morphed or it mutated over time. It began as in one form and it changed. Historically, if we ask the question, how can we prove the iron is Rome? Historically, the Roman kingdom did come after the Grecian. It was the fourth kingdom, as it's referred to in two places, in both Daniel chapter 2 and in Daniel chapter 7. We know that the Romans used iron in weaponry, in their spears, swords, shields. They were all made of iron. Biblically, there are a number of points that indicate that the iron power is Rome. For example, in Deuteronomy 28, Moses foretold that if Israel was disobedient, God would send against them a nation that would put a yoke of iron upon them. That nation would come from the ends of the earth. It would fly as an eagle. They would speak a strange language, and they would besiege their cities, all of which Rome did. We want to spend a little bit of time looking at the development of the Roman Empire. As Bible students, brothers and sisters and young people, we need to have a pretty good concept of what the Roman Empire was about. And what we're going to do with the aid of maps is to just very quickly have a look at how the empire evolved over time. Now, one of the things to observe, to start with, is that we talk about the Roman Empire, but in fact, it had three forms, if you like. It started as a monarchy, then a republic, then an empire. Now, this little marker that you can see here, that indicates the point in time that the map relates to. So what we can see to start with is that that Rome extended westward before it extended eastward. It extended westward, eastward, and then north and south. In 186 BC, Rome defeated Graecia at the Battle of Pydna, which we've just looked at, and further east it occupied the Kingdom of Pergamum. Now, this area here, the Kingdom of Pergamum and Macedonia and Greece, was previously occupied by two of Alexander's generals, Lysimachus and Cassander. So you can see the empire is extending eastward. During the first century BC, Rome accumulated military and political power. In 51 BC, Gaul was conquered by Rome's most famous general, Julius Caesar, and that extended the border of the Roman Empire to the Rhine River. And you can see, as I said, the little marker moving across the bottom as we progress through the slide. So as I said, we're just going to go through this quickly just to give you a bit of a visual of the development of the empire. The adopted son of Julius Caesar, Octavian, founded the Roman Empire and took the name of Augustus. And his long reign brought a period of peace across the Roman frontier. Augustus continued to extend Rome's borders, but after he was defeated a number of times in Germany, he decided to establish some boundaries, some natural boundaries for the kingdom or the empire, and that was the Rhine, the Danube, and the Euphrates River. So he was the first ruler over the empire itself. The empire continued to extend its boundaries during the first century by conquering Britain, Thrace, Cappadocia and Mauritania. And I don't know if Brother Bill is here tonight, but he did share with me the reason why Rome never conquered Scotland. And you may have heard this, that when the Romans saw the Scottish people coming over the hill wearing kilts, they thought, man, if their women look like that, imagine how ugly their men are. So that's history according to Brother Bill Robson. So by now, Rome had encircled the Mediterranean. It was truly an empire of the sea. Now, this slide's interesting, although it mightn't appear that way initially. The last major battles were fought by Trajan in the early 2nd century against the Dacians of the north of the Danube, then the Parthians in Armenia and in Mesopotamia. But note this, that whilst Rome tried to occupy this territory over here that had been occupied by the Persian and Greek kingdoms, they failed to hold that territory. And we're going to see the relevance of that later on in Daniel. So Rome, by this point in history, began to consolidate its frontiers. In the middle of the 3rd century, the empire was again threatened by the Franks, the Alemanni, and the Goths. However, emperors Diocletian and Constantine managed to, for a period at least, maintain the borders. Now, in this period of time, there were some really interesting things happened. First of all, in 313, following his battle at Milvian Bridge, Constantine, we might say, Christianized the empire. And that's very relevant for when we think about the image that we have a transition of what the iron represents from the legs to the feet and toes, which we're going to get to. So in 313, Constantine Christianized the empire. In 320, he established a new capital at Constantinople, and he moved both the military and the civil rule to Constantinople. And around 330, In 320, he founded the new capital. 330, he moved both the civil and the military there. And from that point in time onwards, the military headquarters was in the east, and the Pope remained in Rome as the head of the church in the west. Following the death of Theodosius in 395, the empire divided between his two sons, confirming the division between the eastern and the western Roman empires. And you'll notice up there that the insignia of this divided empire was a double-headed eagle. And why a double-headed eagle? Because it signifies that there were two parts to the empire. And what we find is that insignia finds its way, it continues in history for 1,000 years or more, even to Moscow itself. We've got two more slides to go, I think. In 406, there were invasions of the Western Roman Empire from the Vandals, the Alans, etc. They crossed over the Rhine River and eventually conquered all of the Western Empire. And so the last emperor of the Western Empire was Romulus, who was deposed by Odoacer the Goth in 476. So Rome was founded by a Romulus, and the last emperor over the Western Empire was a Romulus. And so then, in 476, brought about a significant change. The empire in the west came to an end. The empire in the east continued until 1453 and became known as the Byzantine Empire. But the Pope remained in Rome, and for about another 1,000 years, emperors remained in control of Constantinople. And we have to ask the question why. That is a significant period of time, from 476 when the Western Empire fell to 1453, Constantinople continued to remain one of the most dominant cities of Europe. Why was that? Because, for two reasons. One is it was strong militarily, and it had enormous walls that were impenetrable until cannons were used for the first time against it. And in 1453, the city fell to the Ottoman Turks, and that marked the end of the Roman Empire that had dominated Europe for 1,500 years. So it's appropriate, perhaps at this point in time, to make a comment about the anatomy of the image. It's fitting that the Medo-Persian Empire is represented by two arms, because it was a joint kingdom. Darius the Mede was Darius and Cyrus were related. The Medes ruled for 2 years and the Persians for 207 years. Likewise, the Grecian kingdom we know had a northern and a southern, they resolved into a northern and a southern kingdom, which are represented by the two thighs. And similarly, Rome, as we've just seen, had two parts, an east and a west, which relate to the two legs. But what we need to understand is this, that as with all figures, the figure or the image has limitations. What do we mean by that? Well, for example, the two thighs of the Grecian Empire did not become the two legs. The two thighs were north and south, you might say, whereas the legs were east and west. And similarly, the Roman Empire was in fact united for a longer period than it was divided. So why mention that? Simply that as Bible students, we should at least be aware of the limitations of the image in depicting history. Okay, so what about the feet and toes of the image? Well, think about this. If the Western Roman Empire ended in 476 BC and the Eastern in 1453, then it's evident that whatever the iron is in the feet has to represent something different to the iron that's in the legs. What is it? Well, it's one thing to be able to give an answer, but it's another thing to be able to prove it. We may be able to prove, for example, what the iron represents, but can we prove what the clay represents? Let's see what we're told about that amalgam in chapter 2 and verses 41 to 43. We read there, let's take a drink of water. Whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. So we're given some clues about what the iron and the clay is. Let's just work through this together. We have a comparison here. Whereas thou sawest, in verse 43, iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men. So the iron is mixed with the clay, and the they refers to the iron, and the seed of men refers to the clay. And we're told, but they wouldn't cleave one to another. So what then do we know about the kingdom of iron and clay? The kingdom has multiple kings. We read that in verse 44. As in the days of these kings. It's comprised of iron and clay, clay being the seed of men, verse 43. And we're told that though the iron mingles with the seed of men, they do not cleave to one another. And the kingdom derives its strength only from the iron, verse 41. So we have to ask the question then, is there anywhere else in Scripture where we're told about iron mixing with the seed of men? Can anyone think of a place in Scripture where we're told about that mixture? Revelation chapter 17. Let's go there. So we're trying to identify not only the iron, but the identity of the clay as well. And we find that mixture of iron and clay in Revelation 17. Revelation 17, verse 1. And there came one of the seven angels, which had seven vials, and talked with me, saying unto me, Come hither, I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters. Now we know a woman is used as a figure of a religious system, a prospective bride of Christ. But this woman, as we're told in verse 1, is a whore. She's an unfaithful religious system. And so the day of her judgment is come. So that's the context of Revelation 17. The day of her judgment is come. And her judgment is going to be at the hands of the Lamb, we're told in verse 14. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is the Lord of lords, King of kings, and they that are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. So it's the same time period as Daniel chapter 2, at the end of the vision. So this is the iron in the iron and the clay at the end of time, as revealed in Revelation 17. The iron is that unfaithful religious system. And where is she centered? We're told in verse 9, and here is the mind that hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. And we're told in verse 18, and the woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. And of course, in John's day, that was Rome. So this woman is Roman. She's religious and she's an unfaithful system. But she's also, as verse 5 says, the progenitor of other apostate religious systems. And in verse 6 we read that she's persecuted the believers. So that's what we're told about the iron. She's Roman in identity or in origin. What about the seed of men? Well, the clay or the seed of men are the kings of the earth with whom she mingles. And we're told of them in verse 2. With whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication. And we're told in verse 18, the woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. And as verse 3 tells us, there are 10 in number, which of course is the same as the number of toes on the image. So the 10 kings are represented by the 10 horns of the beast. So how does the iron mingle with the clay? Well, note that it says in verse, the answer is she allures them by unholy means in order to reign over them. So where do we see that today? Do we see evidence of that happening today? This is how the iron and the clay are mingling in our time. Here's a picture that was taken in 2017. It was held in Rome, and the Pope got together with the leaders of the EU, the leaders of the European Union in 2017. And it's interesting to see how this was reported by the press. Divine intervention. EU leaders will turn to who? The Pope, over plans to revive the struggling bloc. And this commentator made this point. Brussels chiefs are hoping the pontiff can provide them the leadership they are lacking to help solve the debilitating crisis tearing the bloc apart. We're told in Daniel chapter 2 that it's the iron that provides the strength to that coalition of entities. We have to ask the question, how is that going to come about? How is it that Rome is going to become the strong element of that union? And I think the answer is hinted at us in that news release. And that is this, that the European leaders are turning to the Pope for stability. So think potentially what would happen if other members of the European Union were to leave. There's good reason to believe, for example, that Greece will not remain part of the European Union. If other nations are to leave the European Union, Who are those nations going to turn to for strength? They are in all likelihood going to involve the Pope in trying to stabilise the European Union. So, perhaps in this diagram here, we have the identity of the iron and the clay established. It can be linked with Revelation 17. It's talking about a Roman religious system reigning over 10 kings of the earth. I was going to spend some time talking about the evolution of the iron power, but it will take longer than 3 minutes, so I might leave that to next class, brothers and sisters and young people, when we'll finish off with that, which will only take 10 minutes, and then we'll get on to chapter 3. Perhaps we might finish with this thought in going back to Daniel chapter 2. Some very consoling words. We live in an uncertain world, and as we said, as was illustrated in the life of Daniel and his three friends in chapter 1, our world, brothers and sisters, can change in the space of a day. But we're told something very consoling in chapter 2, or at least I find it very consoling, is that this: the dream is certain and the interpretation thereof sure.